Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During question and answer, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you can disconnect at this time. Now I will turn the conference over to Janet Kaladner. You may begin.
Hi, welcome. My name is Janet Kaladner, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the last one of this year's talks in our series on this our series of distinguished lectures on designing disruptive learning technologies. Today we have Chris Deedy from Harvard University, and he's going to tell us about how immersive learning environments of several different kinds that use augmented and virtual reality can foster learning and allow data collection to allow assessment and automated feedback. But before he begins, I want to start by saying a few words about the series and about Chris. The series is organized by the Cyber Learning and Future Learning Technologies Program Working Group at the National Science Foundation. The Cyber Learning Program is a joint effort of 4 NSF directorates, Computer and Information Sciences and Engineering, that's FIVE, Education and Human Resources, that's EHR, Social Behavioral and Economic Sciences, SBE, and Engineering. The mission of the Cyber Learning Program is twofold. First, to imagine and anticipate the next generation of learning technologies, what they might be and how to use them, the ones that will be used on a regular basis 10, 15, 20 years from now, in school and out of school and by people of all ages. The second part of the program's mission is to advance our understanding about how learning happens, how to foster learning, how to assess learning, with a special focus on learning that happens in context where learners can have experiences made possible by technology and where technology can collect data that could not be collected otherwise. Another part of that part of the mission is to advance our understanding of how to design for learners. Our speaker today, Chris Deedy, has been leading the way, along with his students and postdocs, in designing immersive interactive learning environments and in learning how to collect and analyze data in those environments that will allow understanding what learners understand and don't understand, what their capabilities are, and what help they need in order to learn, to better understand. His software, River City, allowed learners to explore a virtual city with a disease outbreak and figure out where it came from and what to do about it. In that environment, they got a chance to interact with virtual members of the population, all of whom knew different things and had different expertise needed to understand issues in science and epidemiology. He will talk today possibly about that, but mostly I think about EcoMove, an immersive learning environment for learning about the environment. And Chris was supposed to be here in March. I was really looking forward to us playing with his software and hearing about it then. But he was snowed out. So I'm really glad we had a chance to reschedule him and that we'll be able both to hear about what he's been doing and to play with the EcoMove software this afternoon at 2:30. So come back at 2:30 to do that. And for now, welcome Chris, and I'll let you take over.
Well, Janet, thank you. And I'm delighted to be here and to share some ideas. The title, New Wine and No Bottles, is a play on a recurrent problem in educational technology, which is these wonderful new tools and media come along, and we use them to automate our old ways of doing things instead of using them to innovate. So it's new wine and old bottles. And in contrast, what I'm going to talk about today with immersive interfaces, particularly augmented reality, is where the bottle itself disappears. So new wine and no bottles. To illustrate those general concepts about virtual worlds and augmented realities, I'm going to refer to our work on EcoMove and EcoMobile. Those are projects that a team of people has done. So I'm really here as the representative of that team. Tina Grotzer, who is my colleague in science education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, has many NSF grants related to understanding complex causality. Amy Kamarainen is an ecosystem scientist with her PhD in limnology, which is water-based ecosystems. And Sherry Metcalf is a computer scientist who developed a system called ModelIt in the late 1990s that was very influential in shaping people's ideas about simulation. So whenever I talk about our projects, I'm really talking about the work of a team of people, not just about me. So this should advance, I hope. No advance. Let me try up here. Nope, not advancing. Any thoughts, Karen, about this? All right, so Karen's going to work on this, and I'm going to talk, because anybody who works with technology knows you've got to be able to dance. What was the magic thing that I needed to do?
The technology is beyond you, Chris.
It is. It's too complicated for me. So it's this. It was the arrow. It's that one. Oh, okay. It is too complicated for me. What can I say? I don't want to start with technology, because when you start with technology, you have a solution looking for a problem, and that's never a good thing. So instead, I want to start with a report that the National Research Council released 2 years ago talking about education for life and work in the 21st century, and the fact that a really good education in 1995 is now not a good education, because we don't have a national industrial economy anymore. We have a global, knowledge-based, innovation-centered economy, and that has changed a tremendous number of things. And one of the interesting things the report does is it divides the knowledge and skills into three areas: the cognitive, the intrapersonal, and the interpersonal. Because there's a lot of research that shows that 10 years after you graduate from any level of education, your interpersonal and intrapersonal skills actually have as much or more to do with your success as your cognitive skills. Now, that's not really a surprise to those of us who've been out in the world for a while. I'm kind of notorious at Harvard because I once asked the dean if it was possible to use the term low maintenance in a faculty job description. It turns out that's illegal. But we all know what that means, because we've all worked with people who might have been really, really smart and knowledgeable, but who were so dysfunctional on an intrapersonal or an interpersonal level that they were a liability rather than an asset. So in the 21st century in particular, where a lot of work is done by teams and not necessarily teams face-to-face, these other skills are really important. And in that report, I don't want to speak for a long time about the report. It's not the focus of the talk, but the report is important in understanding how the objectives of education are changing. And if you look at these illustrative skills from the report in the three columns, and you map that onto where we spend our time, both in pre-college education and in higher education, it's striking how some of the cells, like cognitive processes and strategies and knowledge, receive a huge amount of attention, and other cells, like creativity, flexibility, work ethic, leadership, conflict resolution, don't receive as much attention. And so one of the things that we need to think about is that not every educational experience needs to do all these things at the same time, but collectively, the kinds of pre-college and higher education experiences we provide should really have a footprint along these lines. And that's not an easy thing to do. So I've thought a lot about this and looked at a lot of work in sort of exemplary models of education. And again, the same themes seem to come up no matter what it's called. So whether it's called personalized education or connected education or deep learning or whatever, some combination of really good classroom instruction, richly contextualized real-world learning like apprenticeships or internships, things you can't teach in a classroom, and then learning communities, sometimes face-to-face, sometimes across distance, it's those three things combined that seem able to produce a footprint that covers these areas. And it's very difficult to imagine getting that footprint with just 2 out of 3, or unfortunately for many people, 1 out of 3 in terms of what's going on. But of these three, the one that's really least developed, the one that we have spent the least resources on and maybe explored the least in terms of technology, is this richly contextualized real-world learning. So in particular, in pre-college education, if you've taught in a school, you know even getting a field trip, a one-day field trip, is a big deal, let alone doing an apprenticeship or internship-based program of the kind that maybe the Met in Providence is noted for, High Tech High in San Diego, high schools that do this. Get down to middle schools, you typically don't find much of this except for service learning. And yet, this is really important in building that footprint that I talked about. So what I'm going to focus on today is how immersive interfaces can help with this second theme, this richly contextualized real-world learning theme, to try to help with the 21st century objectives, understanding that the immersive interfaces can do other things as well. So for more than 20 years, I've been studying immersion and learning. We've all experienced immersion. You go to the movies, maybe you go to see The Hobbit, and about 5 minutes after the movie starts, you're no longer psychologically sitting in a movie theater surrounded by strangers. You are somewhere in Middle Earth with Gandalf and Bilbo. So immersion is where psychologically you feel located somewhere that your body is not. And you can get immersion from reading a really good novel. So there's nothing new about this. But our interfaces for inducing immersion have become much more powerful. And in particular, in reading the novel or in watching the movie, it's a weak form of immersion because it's passive. You're just observing. But what my colleagues and I study is strong forms of immersion where you're active and you can shape the environment that you're immersed in. So 22 years ago in 1992, a colleague and I were funded by NSF to study full-fledged virtual reality with head-mounted display and computerized clothing. And then in 1999, I started to work on River City that Janet talked about, and for 10 years with some NSF funding explored virtual environments. And more recently, and starting in about 2005, I began to do some early work with mobile learning and augmented reality. And so these themes, as the technologies keep progressing, have become of greater and greater interest. And here I'm going to center on the second and third things, virtual environments and augmented realities. So virtual environments are like Alice in Wonderland. You go through the monitor window and you become a digital person in a virtual world. Augmented realities is like the movie The Terminator with the robot. You're wandering through the real world, but you have magic eyes and you can see an overlay on top of the real world that helps to inform you and helps to make you more powerful. And for all of these interfaces, whether it's AR, VR, or virtual worlds, there's three E's. One of the things that they do that's powerful for learning is they evoke very rich settings. So I talked earlier about richly contextualized real-world learning. In a classroom, what can you do? You can show people pictures. You can show them a video. You can maybe have a guest expert come in across distance, but you can't really give people the feeling of being inside of the real world. And these technologies are very evocative. Engagement, well, we see from games, internet games in particular, that these can be very powerful in terms of engagement, but when they look like the real world, they also see relevance, and they also can develop, as we'll talk about, greater feelings that they themselves can cope with whatever is being presented. Their self-efficacy goes up. And then evidence, like social media, these are things that live on a server, and so these immersive interfaces collect very rich kinds of big data that, if we understand how to interpret it, can really help us with both diagnostic assessment and summative assessment. So think about the three E's. So in about 2007, Tina Grotzer, my colleague, had been doing her work in science education with complex causality. I had been doing my work with virtual worlds and early work with augmented realities, and we wanted to work together because I had done some work with teaching systems thinking in the 80s, and I'd always been very interested in complex causality and had a healthy respect for how hard it was to teach based on my experiences. So we decided to combine our forces. She had done some work on complex causality in ecosystems, but she'd hit kind of a glass ceiling in terms of what students could learn within the limits of the classroom. So I said, well, maybe immersive interfaces can help. And of course, environmental literacy is very important, and it's something that students really resonate to because they can see it as part of their everyday lives, but it's kind of underdeveloped in the Common Core and the next generation science standards. Similarly, both kids and adults often don't understand complex causality. One of the reasons that so many of our most resistant 21st century problems keep hanging around and getting worse is because people don't understand the complex causality that underlies them. And in ecosystems, you can't do the kinds of controlled experiments that might characterize the physical sciences or the biological sciences. It's a little more like medicine, where you've got to be careful what you're experimenting on. And so there's a different kind of epistemology that we wanted people to understand. And then, of course, this is also science that takes a stance. Ecosystem science is about stewardship. It's not simply about understanding the natural world. It's about being a steward of the natural world. And so there's a values dimension to it that's important that makes it more complicated to teach. So we thought, well, this is a good challenge for us to take on, doing something in environmental education. Now, of course, NSF has already done some creative things in environmental education that speak to the kinds of challenges that I've raised. So the Global Forest Watch is an example of a project that follows in a long string of citizen science projects where people locally collect data and they locally get involved and understand science, but also that data is integrated in ways that help advance the scientific enterprise itself. So we knew that we wanted to build on things like that. Also, you may know that there's a NEON initiative that NSF is leading, where over four decades, all of the major biomes in the United States are going to have rich sensor networks embedded in them. So there'll be a tremendous amount of sensor data, and the public needs to be prepared to understand that if they're going to be able to make good decisions as citizens, because as you know, there's a lot of information and misinformation that the public wrestles with in terms of environmental science. So with that as a prelude, let's talk about virtual worlds in terms of their capabilities for immersive learning, and let's use EcoMove as an example. So this was funded by the U.S. Department of Education, Institute of Educational Sciences. It was a four-year project focused on middle school and three goals in terms of learning: ecosystems, science concepts, inquiry as a collaborative process, and complex causality that underlies ecosystems. So we developed either a two-week or a four-week ecosystem science curriculum based on two digital ecosystems that's now been released under a free license from Harvard, so it's being used in a variety of places, and you yourselves can use it this afternoon, or if you can't come this afternoon and you pick up a copy of the handout, you can use it without having me around to support you, because of course, if it's going to be practical to use in schools, it's got to be the kind of thing that people can use without a lot of supports to do it. So on the left, you see a pond called Black's Nook. This is near Harvard. It is part of the Cambridge Public Schools. They have a little environmental station there, If you go to middle school in Cambridge, maybe once or twice during those years, you'll go for an afternoon out to the pond. It's fun. It's interesting. It has very little impact on learning, unfortunately, because it's this isolated drop from the sky experience where most of the time you're just sort of mucking around and the teacher's trying to keep kids from falling into the pond and so on. But it's a great site, and what we did with Amy's help to make sure our ecosystem science was authentic was to prepare not just a simulation of that particular pond, although we used that pond as an example, but a rather generic simulation of a water-based ecosystem. Now, in order to give you a feel for what this looks like, the easiest thing for me to do is to show you a video clip. So this is background on what it might be like to be a student using the pond part of the EcoMove curriculum.
Research project at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. They use an immersive virtual environment to teach middle school students about ecosystems and causal patterns. It includes two computer-based modules, Pond and Forest, within a four-week inquiry-based ecosystems curriculum. Here we are in the pond module. We can walk around the pond and see all the different plants and animals, like these ducks. The camera tool lets us take pictures, and saving the photo displays a virtual field guide with information about each of the organisms we find. We can also walk under the water to see the species living there. And using a virtual microsubmarine, we can shrink down and see the microscopic life in the pond at different levels of magnification.
This gives the students a profound respect for why you don't drink pond water.
The environment around the pond includes features like a golf course, roads, and houses. Following this runoff pipe leads us to a drainage ditch near a new housing development where we meet a landscaper putting down fertilizer. Throughout the environment, on different days, you meet virtual characters like Manny, who may provide useful information. Back at the pond, the water measurement tool let us take various measurements of the water in the pond, such as phosphates and turbidity. Students can collect weather and population data as well. The calendar tool lets us travel through time in order to see how the pond has changed on different days. Here, it's raining. When we walk under the water, we can see how cloudy the water is. The turbidity is higher, and we can also take another measurement. The data view lets us see and compare data we've collected. The atom tracker tool lets us see what happens to atoms in the ecosystem over time. We can find and track three atoms, carbon, phosphorus, and oxygen. On each simulated day, we can find the atom tracker signs and read a description of what has happened to each atom since our last visit. Here we see an oxygen atom that is part of a water molecule in the leaf of a tree. And then on our next visit, we see that through photosynthesis, the oxygen atom is being released into the air as part of an O2 molecule. As students explore different days at the pond, they discover that on July 28th, all the large fish in the pond are dead. Through the inquiry-based curriculum, students work in teams to collect and analyze data in order to figure out what killed the fish. Once the students have collected all the data, they can use the graphing tool to compare different variables to help them create concept maps that explain why the fish died. Through an exploration of the pond scenario within this immersive simulated environment, students develop a richer understanding of complex causal relationships and ecosystems.
All right, so I'm going to pause there and go back to this. Now, I'm not going to go deeply into discussing this because that's getting bogged down in the example is not the point, but this is a container. Virtual worlds are a container into which many kinds of things can go. So kids can sit in a classroom in Massachusetts in the middle of the winter, or they can sit in a classroom in Arizona where there isn't a pond for any considerable distance. and they can be immersed as ecosystem scientists in a pond trying to figure out what's going on. That's the fundamental point. This is based on a jigsaw pedagogy, so there are teams of four. Each person on the team does about a quarter of what an ecosystem scientist would do, and then they have to combine their data to understand what's going on. So that helps to develop some of these interpersonal skills and intrapersonal skills that we were describing. And, of course, over time, students can rotate roles so that they gradually learn the full skill set of an environmental scientist. Also, this helps teachers because if you've got a student, for example, who has difficulty reading, maybe they're dyslexic or maybe they're an English language learner, you can give them a role initially that doesn't involve so much reading so that they can still play a really useful role on the team and build their self-efficacy, but at the same time they're working with people that are reading, so they're seeing the value of being able to do reading. Not everything that happens inside of the virtual world. This is an example of a food web tool. The whole parts of magic that happen in the world, shrinking down in the submarine, the atom tracker, things like the food web tool, are designed around misconceptions that middle school kids typically have about ecosystems and complex causality. So the submarine is a way of showing them things that are invisible that affect the causality. The atom tracker is a way of showing the matter, the flow of matter through the system, which typically wouldn't be visible. This is a way of showing them the energy flows through the system, which typically wouldn't be visible. So we're trying to build up a mental model in their mind of all the different ways that complex causality works. And you saw at the end of the video this collaborative construction of concept maps. So at the end of the unit, each team of four participates in a little scientific conference where they get up and they present their findings to the class, and even more important, they produce the evidence behind their findings to the class so that the teacher is able to judge not only what they understood and didn't understand about the complex causality, but also what they did and didn't understand about inquiry and about making evidence-based arguments. And, of course, the teacher can see a little bit about their collaborative abilities, their self-efficacy, how engaged they seem to be, and some of these other dimensions that we were describing. But that isn't the only form of assessment. And, in fact, one of the advantages of immersive interfaces is that they enable new methods of assessment beyond what might be typical for project-based learning and beyond the kinds of pre-post, multiple-choice and short-answer instruments that researchers typically use. And this is really important because we can't really get things like virtual worlds or augmented realities into the curriculum unless we can assess their true value, which means being able to assess along all the dimensions in that footprint that I described earlier, not just the narrow dimensions that you can assess with traditional measures. Also, if you use only the traditional measures, then these new kinds of media don't look that different in terms of their instructional outcomes, whereas if you're able to use a broader spectrum of assessments, you get to see what they're really accomplishing. And in particular, because it lives on a server, EagleMove and all the other virtual worlds give you this incredibly rich second-by-second information about what each student is doing, where they go, who they talk to, what they say, what they hear, what they activate and don't activate, what they share in the notebook for their teammates, what data they collect, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this creates a huge problem because these log files are intellectually indigestible. And so a lot of work in learning analytics is going on for all parts of cyber infrastructure, not just virtual worlds and immersive interfaces, trying to understand how to analyze and digest this data. And we've done some work on that in the River City project that Janet mentioned, in another project funded by NSF I'm not going to talk about today called Virtual Performance Assessments, where we developed a rubric for analyzing the kind of rich data that came out of that. But even without advancing learning analytics completely, there's a lot that we can do now with diagnostic assessments that are formative for learning. So they're happening in near real time, and they're really shaping instruction and learning rather than waiting for those summative assessments and that science conference at the end and the pre-post measures that we use to judge the effectiveness of EcoMove as an outcome, because that's too late for students and teachers. So one of the things we did with River City is that we're now doing with EcoMove is we collected path data. And we displayed for students in River City their paths, both individually and as a team, exploring each time they went back in the time machine. And then we showed them expert paths. And just with that feedback, without the teacher spending any time explaining what was going on, we saw dramatic improvements in what students were doing. Another thing that we borrowed from games was to use heat maps, which not only capture path, but they also show how long somebody stays at a particular point. And in this particular heat map, we took the students who were high performing in terms of inquiry skills and the students who were low performing in terms of inquiry skills. The high performing was green, the low performing was sort of pink. And you can see that if you superimpose the two, a lot is depending on where they're spending their time. So this was another kind of feedback that we could provide to students and teachers that turned out to be pretty effective. We built individualized guidance into River City, something that we haven't yet done with EcoMove, but that we may with the new grant that we have to extend the environment. And, of course, beyond providing support for students, the hint system lets you know whether students need a hint and how deep in the hint tree they're going. So that provides a kind of diagnostic information that, if it's fed back to the teacher, can be very helpful with the teacher knowing who's struggling and what they're struggling with. Something that we did in River City, but this is an example of it, is animated pedagogical agents. So you can meet computer-controlled agents of the kind that you saw in the EcoMove video who will interact with you and who will tell you things. This is an example of one of my doctoral students who did a lot of work with NASA and was part of a NASA education program where they took NASA scientists, and the scientist would adopt an elementary school classroom. And then the kids could interact with the scientist and increase their interest and increase their knowledge. And she wanted to do her dissertation on this, and I said, well, yeah, but it's not scalable. You know, you run out of NASA scientists long before you run out of elementary school classrooms. Why don't we study something that is scalable? So I gave her a couple options, and she chose this one. And she designed Dr. C, who was an animated pedagogical agent that simulated a NASA scientist. Now, this is not artificial intelligence. This is not some elaborate natural language recognition expert system. This is a very crude Wizard of Oz kind of interface where it looks at keywords and it has a big frequently asked questions data bank and it grabs a frequently asked question and feeds it back. So some of the time it says, I didn't understand what you said, could you please repeat? Some of the time when it gives an answer, the answer is off target. But it was very easy to create. And what the research showed, not surprisingly, was that compared to a real NASA scientist who was highly engaged and who knew how to talk to kids, this was inferior. But compared to a real NASA scientist who wasn't highly engaged, or compared to a real NASA scientist who didn't know how to talk to kids, this was superior. And of course, this is eminently scalable. So there's a lot that can be done in these virtual worlds with embedding agents that both can be educational and can be diagnostic in terms of what's asked to them and what kinds of answers are given to them. And these don't knock kids out of flow when they're in the world because they're actually part of the storyline rather than the teacher coming over and saying, what are you doing and why, or some other kind of voice of God intervention that tends to make kids really dislike what's going on. I mentioned briefly the virtual performance assessments. One of the ways we can try to measure transfer is to put students in a different world. So we have a forest ecosystem, and one of the ways that we can measure transfer, although we haven't done extended studies of this at this point, is to have them do the pond, then move them over into the forest and see which kinds of particularly inquiry strategies, but also ecosystem science knowledge, they can transfer into a different environment that, in fact, has a different kind of complex causality, predator-prey causality, associated with it. Building on games, another thing that we've done in terms of feedback is you can attain powers through your accomplishments and your experiences, but we didn't want the powers to be something like flying, because then you're just using extrinsic motivation unrelated to learning. So in River City, we constructed this kind of spooky house. You could only get into different parts of the house if you accomplished enough within your role in River City, and then you could access special things, but the special things let you go back in time, or they let you have superpowers that let you see an aura around people who were going to get sick. So it was all geared around intrinsic engagement. And the point that I want to make is that in the long run, one of the biggest powers for learning of these immersive interfaces is going to be these embedded diagnostic assessments that are don't interfere with learning, that are kind of stealth assessments, as Val Shute would say, but that provide rich diagnostic information for students and teachers if we can find ways to understand through learning analytics the big data that's coming out. And so these are all interesting ways to think about that. But if you step back for a minute to where I started, that this is somehow trying to get at this issue of real-world learning when you can't do real-world learning, these are all the kind of proxies that a mentor might use in the real world. If somebody was an apprentice and you were watching what they were doing and you were trying to figure out how they were learning. Now, EcoMove is a model. So it's authentic. It's as authentic as we could make it as a model, but it's also inauthentic, because any model simplifies things. So there are parts of this that are very good for learning ecosystem science, and there are other parts, like collecting data, that are deceptive about what's involved in ecosystem science. This is kind of like a flight simulator if you're learning to fly an airplane. There's a lot of advantages to a flight simulator, but it's definitely not the same as flying a plane. And we wanted to understand both transfer. So once you really mastered the model, does that mean that you were transferring this into looking at the world? And we also wanted to understand how this might relate to augmented reality and whether it made sense for us to bring in the second kind of immersive interface. So we did a lot of different kinds of research on EcoMove, including comparing EcoMove to a project-based learning curriculum that didn't use immersive interfaces, which I'm not going to talk about today, but I am going to talk about this one piece of research that tried to look at EcoMove and whether it primed people for learning in the real world through field trips. So as part of our initial research, we had classes use EcoMove and then go on the field trip, and we wanted to see if there were things that transferred from EcoMove to help make the field trip more effective, just a standard, ordinary field trip. And what we found is that, in fact, we did see gains from students in inquiry if they did EcoMove first before they went on the field trip. We had identified three aspects that we thought EcoMove might be effective on: making observations, using the data collection tools, and using evidence-based reasoning. We did find gains in terms of observations. These slides are available, so I'm not going to linger on them. We did not find, at least in that design, that tool use was enhanced, so we needed to think about that more. We did find that the explanations improved, and so that helped get us feeling that we were on the right track in terms of moving towards EcoMobile. So if EcoMove is like Minecraft, EcoMobile is like Neon, or, you know, the global network of sensors. How do you prepare people for that? Now, what makes all this possible, this new kind of immersive interface, is handheld devices. Some of you may remember 38 years ago, the first powerful handheld device for learning, the Little Professor calculator from Texas Instruments, One of the great tragedies of my life is I now look like the little professor. I never thought I would get this old, never. And, of course, in 2014, our handheld devices are much, much more powerful than that was. And so we took the same pond, Black's Nook, as our first example, and we said, why don't we augment around the pond and have different stations that kids can go to and see what they can learn beyond a standard field trip where we're trying to augment the field trip. And also, let's have them use probeware and collect real data because we want to overcome misconceptions that the simulator might create about how easy it is to collect data and how variable data is. So EcoMobile, we're toward the end of year three of a four-year funded project. Qualcomm helped us in the first year. It's complementary to EcoMove, but our primary emphasis is EcoMobile, and it integrates a lot of research on augmented reality that different groups have done beforehand. So you've got this pod that we've augmented. You'll see in a video in a minute that we have ways of using the mobile devices to help provide assistance for students and understanding, like embedded kinds of visualizations and simulations. We also can call students' attention to things that they might ignore, like this deer scat that is in the pond environment that you might just, if you weren't looking for it as an ecosystem scientist would, you wouldn't see what was involved. So this is an example of location-based augmented reality. Here's a video about EcoMobile.
EcoMobile is a program we've been developing for middle school students that helps them to connect with their learning in the classroom with the real-world experience. So they've been able to work in the classroom in their science class with a multi-user virtual environment where they explore a virtual pond, and they act like scientists to collect information about an ecological mystery that's happened at the virtual pond. But then, now we've developed EcoMobile to allow the students to take some of the pieces that they're learning about in the classroom and learn more about them in the real world. So we've developed an augmented reality game that the students can play on smartphones using a 3G wireless network at a real pond. So as the students move around the real environment, they encounter hotspots. And at hotspots, there is information that connects with what they were learning in the classroom. Things like what's a producer, a consumer, a decomposer, or allows them to take measurements of the pond test water quality. The students have been coming out with us to the pond environment and going on field trips and using augmented reality to connect their experiences with the classroom.
I'd like to know what is the most common type of work you're doing out there?
Honestly, you could prove a lot of
these produce. You might see a lot of green, and all of these
smart
trees are
produced. Yeah.
The kids have been very excited to use the smartphone devices, and it's amazing to see how quickly they can pick it up and use it to its full capacity. It took a very short introduction for the kids to be able to navigate with the device and to access these hotspots. And they were figuring things out and troubleshooting together. It was really fun to see them work together to solve some of the problems that they were encountering. And you know, one student might not quite understand how something works, and another student was right there to help them figure it out. Some of the programs they're using and the probes that they're using are very similar to what real scientists use to monitor ecosystems. And so they're getting experiences that rival what real scientists do, and they realize that, and they see things about the water quality and start to understand what this means for, you know, we've had a lot of rain in the last few days. They're connecting the fact that the rain might affect what's happening in the pond and what's happening in their local environment. They're starting to understand that the things that happen in the world are affecting things very close to their home.
The higher and more cloudy, and the lower, the less cloudy.
The less cloudy.
I think
it's 0 to 20.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. All right, that was a good prediction. Now let's see if you were right.
Okay. Could you get the bucket?
Yeah.
Yes. You're gonna need to tap on that.
Did you fill it out?
Yeah. It's set up to the. Make sure it isn't lined up.
All right, let's see.
All right, now it's on a screen. So it's channel 2, so it's the brown one.
Okay.
So why is it going up?
Because
if we didn't have these phones, the students wouldn't have a good way to access some of the additional information that connects with the classroom. Their experiences in the real world when we've gone on field trips with them before have been these one snapshot kind of activities that when they go back to the classroom, it's really hard to remember what they did or why it mattered. But now that we have the phones to connect their experiences in the classroom with the real world, we can take the phones back to the classroom and use them to help the students connect with their learning in both places.
This is awesome.
Yeah.
We get to like learn about like the dissolved oxygen in this case, and we're answering the question that, and we can test the water in the, and yeah, it's awesome. It's much better than using a textbook because you're in it. You can see everything instead of just reading, and
yeah.
The questions are related to what you can physically do instead of just what you know from your knowledge. So.
All right, so got to get myself back here. So this is an interesting complement, and again, this is trying to address this issue of what do we do to have richly contextualized real-world experiences. So we've done a variety of things to try to study our augmented realities. And I don't have time to report on all the kinds of outcomes from that. Augmented realities are much easier to create technically than virtual worlds, but they're still very tricky in terms of the instructional design. And in particular, what you don't want kids to do is to be out in a rich real world environment staring into their mobile device. So it turns out that it's quite challenging to figure out just the right things to do that draw kids into the environment rather than out of the environment. So one of the things that we examined is this issue of how you go out and do authentic science and then come back into the classroom and make sense of it. And we did one set of augmented reality implementations where we contrasted a highly structured augmented reality versus a free choice augmented reality to see what the trade-offs were between those two. And both were similar in many respects, except for the autonomy that students had. So in the first case, which was the highly structured one, we had a lot of activities that involved the students with data collection. And those paths were different for different teams. So students on different teams would wander around. They would find things out about oxygen, for example. They'd see simulations at another place about oxygen. They would collect information about oxygen in this particular pond, and then they would synthesize all of that. And what we found is that the teacher felt that this really helped compared to a regular field trip, because at a regular field trip, all the students are standing next to the teacher is shouting, some of them are engaged, some of them aren't engaged. Here, the mobile devices help to keep the students on task, and they could separate and go all across the whole ecosystem. And we were able to show some significant learning gains compared to a regular field trip with the augmented field trip. The other was the more unstructured, where we wanted to emphasize student autonomy. So we had a virtual mentor. This is actually the Cambridge Public Schools teacher who is at the field site for Black's Nook, so she's kind of a naturalistic expert. And the students went around to different hotspots at their discretion. One of the things we found, of course, that we should have anticipated as designers is that no matter what advice we gave the students, they always went to the hotspots that were closest. So the natural kind of conservation of effort thing. But we did find a way around that inadvertently. I was on an implementation last fall where there'd been a tremendous amount of rain the day before, and there was a part of the pond where it was treacherous and slippery and muddy. And so before the kids started, we said, stay away from that part of the pond, it's dangerous. And every single kid, of course, immediately went to the farthest part of the pond so they could do that. So now we know how to handle this issue of dispersion among hotspots. But notice that the kids are collecting a lot of things, including a lot of things that we wouldn't have put into the augmented reality. They found on their own. So now they're sort of co-designers of the augmented reality in the citizen science sense. And then they come back to the class and they construct a rich multimedia picture. And, of course, there's a lot of ways that that could go beyond what we're doing in our experience. And, again, the teachers kind of like this version as well. They like the structured version, but they also like the unstructured version. And so there might be an interesting kind of dynamic tension between the two where you want to do both. So I want to wrap up so that there's time for questions. So let me just say a couple kinds of things. First, I don't want you to be fooled by these examples into thinking that this is a talk about ecosystem science. This is a talk about containers. These are containers. Virtual worlds and augmented realities are containers that are part of cyber infrastructure, and they can have all sorts of stuff in them. You could have a virtual mall in which you made visible the flow of goods, the flow of people, and the flow of money, and then kids could go to the real mall, and it would be augmented to help them understand economics. You could have them take their own city and do a kind of historical virtual world that showed the city itself changing over time. And then they could go around to the houses in their own neighborhood, and people could bring down old photos out of the attic, and they could do an augmented reality about the history of their immediate area. So not just for STEM, but broadly across the curriculum, there's some very interesting things that we can think about to put in these containers and to use with cyber infrastructure if we understand how to use them well for learning. Because, of course, it's easier to build a bad virtual world for learning than a good one. It's easier to build a bad augmented reality than a good one. This is not about technology. This is about instructional design. The technology itself doesn't make the learning better or worse. It creates an environment with the three E's, evocative, engaging, and evidence. And only if you take good advantage of those three do you get a gain in terms of learning. Ultimately, of course, the bottom line is transfer. It doesn't matter if we build some wonderful virtual worlds and wonderful augmented realities, in this case for environmental science, and then at the end of the day, kids go out into the real world and behave in exactly the same way as they would have without this. And I think that one of the things that's going to be important for the field is to look at how you scaffold transfer in both surface and deep features of these media so that we get the kind of impact that we really would like to have. So with that, I just want to say that I hope you find this work as interesting as I do, and we're going to continue for the next 3 years our work in both EcoMove and EcoMobile and try to get farther along in a lot of these issues. And I want to thank the many, many people who've been involved in this project. So thanks for listening. So we've got some minutes for questions, and anything you want to talk about, including things I didn't talk about, is on the table.
Thank you. At this time, we will begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. One moment while we wait on questions in queue.
So, questions from people here. Or comments. Yes.
So, obviously, you know, one of the functions of the EcoMobile is structuring the interaction between the abstract representations and the environment for understanding the conceptual domain. What have you been finding about using it to structure some of those interpersonal and intrapersonal types of outcomes?
In EcoMobile, we have teams of two, and each has a mobile device. Typically, one has the graphing calculator with the probeware, and the other has a smartphone. Where we don't do the graphing calculator with the probeware, one has the smartphone for taking notes using Evernote, and the other has the smartphone for where the hotspots and the AR software. So it's not a team of four, but it's still teams of two, and by differentiating what each team does, we can get a kind of jigsaw pedagogy. But it isn't the same as the pond. You're not having a crisis event like the fish kill. You're not having traveling back and forth in time. You're not having the same kind of scientific convention where different teams are presenting evidence. You're more having a deconstructing session after the pond. One of the things that we've done that's been very interesting that we're just starting to study is the last time the kids went out, we put GoPros on their heads. And GoPros are a new kind of camera with audio that has come out of adventure gaming. So you wear it and then you post your exploits on the internet. We were amazed to find that the video quality and the audio quality from these GoPro mounts was excellent. And we had been following kids around with a camera, and of course that constrained both what they could do and also what they said, whereas with the GoPro they forget they're wearing it. So we think that that has some great research possibilities, including capturing some of these intrapersonal and interpersonal dimensions. But we also think, in terms of the sensors and capturing the biomes, turning kids loose on biomes that we want to document and doing AR, but also having them wear GoPros and then create multimedia representations of what they found, putting that up on the internet, accumulating that over time. There's a whole other level of citizen science that we think is possible coming out of something like that. Yeah.
I'm Liz Cousins, a great science teacher from Ohio, and so this gets me very excited. But what I'm curious about is, are you looking at ways to assist other schools and communities to create their own, given their specific location?
Yes, one of the challenges with augmented reality is that unlike the Eco Move, where you can download anywhere in the world, you can download and use this. In an augmented reality, you're augmenting a local reality. And the strength is that actually the kids love the Eco Move, but they're actually ascribe much higher relevance to their own ecosystem in their own backyard, appropriately. We hope in another year to release templates. So we've got a water-based ecosystems AR that's geared around a pond. But the template might say, well, do you have a marsh? Do you have a swamp? Do you have a stream? Do you have a drainage ditch? You know, do you have anything that's got water in it? Here's some subset of the pond stuff that you could do. Because, again, technically, programming this is much easier than a virtual world. There's a Google Earth interface so that you can just look at a God's eye view of what you want to augment, and then you pull up the geo-coordinates right out of Google Earth and put them into the authoring shell. So that part of it isn't bad. It's getting the design right that's challenging. So we're doing some experiments now with teachers kind of creating their own augmented realities given a template. It's not straightforward yet. And the authoring shell isn't straightforward yet, and the mobile devices aren't straightforward yet, but it's a moving target, right? It's cyber infrastructure. And so stuff that's hard now, we think in 2-3 years, it's going to be right in the sweet spot, and we hope that we'll have the kind of templates that teachers can use.
I guess one other question. Are you looking at partnering with companies that provide textbooks and computer interfaces with the textbooks with school systems?
Well, this has been a considerable frustration on my part. 10 years of funding went into River City, but River City as a curriculum was built in kind of an outmoded game shell. And we could not find a publisher that was willing to take it on almost more or less for free. And we couldn't get funding from any group to rewrite River City in a modern shell and then just release it for free. So it's essentially gone. EcoMove, the technology was farther along and we were smarter. So we built it in a very strong authoring shell, and it is released for free by Harvard. And actually, I'm working at the moment to get a Chinese version of EcoMove because I also study scale. And I would love to have 10 million Chinese students doing EcoMove. So I'm working on that one. Our luck with publishers has been low. Same problem with EcoMove is with River City. Publishers are used to fire and forget things like textbooks or video clips. They're not used to services that live on a server like virtual worlds or potentially augmented realities. But in the long run, I think that industry will change as well. Jeff?
So you keep referring to the interfaces, immersive interfaces, as opposed to the immersive environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder why you focus on the interface as opposed to the environment.
Well, I guess that's probably due to my own role in this as a developer, is that as a developer, I'm always thinking about the authoring shell itself, what it enables you to do, what it doesn't enable you to do, how you work around its limitations, and how you work around the limitations of the school infrastructures where this is implemented. But you're right that from the user's perspective, hopefully the interface is that what you're focused on is the experience. So I think I'm just having a role at
Excuse me, this is the operator. Please continue to stand by. Please continue to stand by. Excuse me, this is the operator. Please continue to stand by. Please continue to stand by. Thank you. Thank you for your participation in today's conference. You may now disconnect.